It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out about a unique effort to trace the health of a Wisconsin waterway and project what the future could hold.
First, we're just 2 months away now from the presidential election, and according to the latest polling, things are getting a little tighter here in Wisconsin. What once was a significant lead for Hillary Clinton has now shrunk, although she's still several points in the lead.
That could be good news for Donald Trump, our next guest says. In a recent piece, he says Trump needs a new state in play in order to win in November, and Wisconsin could be where he makes a move. There's been plenty of talk in recent months about Wisconsin's status as a battleground state. So just how important might we be in the coming weeks and months for both candidates?
Jim Newell joins us now. He's a staff writer for Slate.com, where he writes about politics. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jim, according to the latest polling, there were a couple of polls showing basically that the distance between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump via the polls has shrunk and it's gotten a lot tighter. So how much ground has Donald Trump made up here in Wisconsin?
Well, if you look at a poll that was taken by the Marquette University Law School poll, which is a pretty well-respected poll, shortly after the conventions in early August, Hillary Clinton was up by 15 percentage points against Donald Trump there. So it looked like it was off the map. Yesterday, the Marquette University Law School released their latest poll, and it had it within, in a two-way race, 3 points, and 5 points in a four-way race. So it looks like it's shrunk about a dozen points, according to that poll. And there's another one released yesterday by Monmouth University that had it at 5 points.
So is that kind of volatility in the polling numbers normal, or does that suggest to you that something big might be shifting here in Wisconsin?
Well, it follows what's going on across the country where the race is tightening a little bit. It's not tightening to the point where they're in a dead heat nationally. We're still trying to see if it's going to stabilize around the 4 to 5 point national lead that we're seeing Clinton at right now. If it doesn't get any tighter, then, you know, obviously this election is going to be a rout. But what we need to look at is if it's going to be a dead heat, if they get tied in national polls, how does that, and state polls usually follow the national movement, then what new states are in play? And it looks like Wisconsin is a state where Donald Trump is performing now at or about his national average.
When you look at the numbers shifting like that, is there any sort of easy explanation, any narrative about why the numbers have changed like that?
Well, I mean, you tend to get a big bounce out of your convention. Trump got a bounce out of the Republican convention, but then the week later, there's a Democratic convention, and Clinton got an even bigger bounce. So you expect that bounce to fade a little bit. And then after the Democratic convention, too, Trump had a couple of pretty bad weeks where he was making a regular series of gaffes. He seems like he stopped that a little bit. He's been a little more controlled. He has a new campaign manager. So he's coming down from his worst period in the race. Now it's just a matter of seeing if he can begin to convert the swing voters who are still really not set on him.
Now, not too long ago, when we were talking polling, and Wisconsin didn't look like it was necessarily in play for Donald Trump. It looks like this would have been a state that Hillary Clinton could have won pretty handily. So now, does it look to you as though Wisconsin is in play and could be a bona fide battleground state?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if we're looking at the electoral map, Trump has a pretty narrow path. And the problem he's had before is, if you take every state that Mitt Romney won in 2012, which is 206 electoral votes, if he were to hold all of those, which is hard enough, he would then have to add Florida, Ohio, Iowa, and Nevada, which are his next best states to poach. But that would only get him to 265 electoral votes. He'd need 270 to win. So then it's a matter of where does he get the possible state to put him over the top. A lot of people have been looking at Pennsylvania because they've had good Republican registration numbers there. And also it's a state with a lot of white working class voters in the western part of the state. But Pennsylvania has really not been that close in the polling. In fact, Trump is doing usually a couple points worse than his national average there. So then you have to find another state. And if Wisconsin is moving back and is competitive, that could be the electoral votes you need to jump him over 270. So it's always been one of these states that's potentially competitive, but it seems like this week it's jumping back into the immediately competitive column.
And Donald Trump has been in Wisconsin quite a bit. I think I don't have numbers in front of me, but I think more than Hillary Clinton has been in here. So based on what you're seeing, are you seeing Donald Trump maybe picking up on exactly what you just said, that electoral calculus, and saying, hey, I got to be in Wisconsin?
I think so. And I think, you know, that may have helped him move. And, you know, we'll probably see Hillary Clinton going there more, Tim Kaine going there more, a lot more Democratic activity there. Because it's, you know, this looks like now it's becoming one of the, you know, potential tipping point states.
We're talking with Jim Newell right now, who writes politics in Slate.com. And he's with us right now talking about Donald Trump's potential possibly to win Wisconsin in November, at least to put Wisconsin back into play. And if you look back into the primary, Jim, it didn't seem like this was necessarily going to be a state that would hold for Donald Trump, especially given the strong presence of the Never Trump movement in Wisconsin. So does this surprise you at all?
Well, it does surprise me a little bit, but I think you're seeing, remember, Donald Trump got trounced in the Wisconsin primary. It was probably the lowest point, but then the primary schedule moved back to the Northeast where he was strong, so he was able to recover. And also Hillary Clinton lost to Bernie Sanders here by a pretty substantial amount. If you look at the Marquette poll from yesterday, you're seeing that among Republicans, Donald Trump has 83% of Republicans in the state in line with him. Hillary Clinton has 89% of Democrats. Usually those numbers are going to be in the 90s for the candidate who wins. So you have a lot of undecided voters in Wisconsin. In a four-way race in the Marquette poll, it was only something like 37-32 when you include the minor party candidates. So there's a lot of indecision there, and it's going to be hard to determine how a lot of these races finally shake out until people make up their minds, which is, you know, people are going to wait to see the debates. They'll just, you know, watch as the election goes on more after Labor Day. So it's, you know, it's not surprising that there are a lot of undecided voters there in both parties.
Right. Can we talk a little more about undecided? You mentioned people maybe wanting to see the debates, wanting to see a little bit more of election politics played out. But beyond that, do you know anything about what sorts of things go through the minds of undecided that they weigh to help them ultimately to make that decision?
You know, for people I've talked to, it's really just a matter of, both of these candidates are so unpopular. Their favorability ratings are just both at prehistoric lows for major party nominees. And what's been helping Clinton is that Trump has always been a little bit worse. So I think you're seeing a lot of people right now who just, the thought of having to vote for either one is really not appetizing to them right now. But as the election gets nearer and if states are really close, you'll probably see people decide to just hold their nose and pull the lever for, you know, whoever they're usually aligned with, whichever party they usually vote for.
So you're saying that's more likely a scenario that they just decide to vote for the candidate that they feel the least revulsion for instead of just abstaining totally?
Well, I mean, there may be some people who abstain. It just depends. This is something where it can make a big difference. If say Donald Trump ends up with 90% of Republicans instead of 95%, I mean, that could be the decider in the election. I think you'll see some people abstain entirely or just write in someone, maybe do a protest vote to a third party candidate. But a lot of people right now who are saying they're undecided and say they'll never vote for either, it's usually the case that down the stretch, at least a pretty sizable number of them will end up going for a major party candidate.
And Jim, we've just got 30 seconds left here. What are you going to be watching for to decide if Wisconsin is going to matter to Donald Trump?
Well, I guess we're going to see if the polling continues to stay, you know, at where it is now, or if it gets even better for Trump. I'm also going to look to see, you know, what kind of advertising purchases they make there for the airwaves. Donald Trump is just starting to make ad buys, so we'll see how much he devotes to Wisconsin. Those sorts of things, yeah.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That was Jim Newell, who writes about politics for Slate.com. He joined us there to talk about Donald Trump's potential to win Wisconsin in November.
A new documentary is airing tonight on Wisconsin Public Television, and it highlights groundbreaking work going on in our state. The documentary follows new research on the Yahara watershed and how the lakes have changed since agriculture became prevalent in the area.
But the AHARA 2070 project goes further than that. It also lays out scenarios about the future of the waterway and how people will use it. And those projections can help to shape our priorities and behavior over the next several decades.
You can't understand the biology and ecology of a lake without understanding the priorities and values and activities of the human beings around the lake.
It's the voice of Steve Carpenter, one of the researchers featured in the documentary, and he joins us now. Steve Carpenter is the director of the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison, as well as a professor of zoology. Steve, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
This AHARA 2070 project, it seems like a really ambitious long-term thinking project. And I think of a lot of times when we're thinking of long-term and environmental stewardship, that's a few years, 5 or 10 years. Why take this really long view?
Well, we thought that most people cared about their grandchildren and probably knew their grandparents. And so it's a time scale humans think about. And it's also the time scale that's relevant to some of the changes we wanted to study. For example, to really understand climate change, you need to be looking out decades. And to really understand the changes in our soils and our waters, you need to take a long view. These things actually unfold over decades, not years.
And reading about the project and looking at the documentary, it seems like it's really easy to think in the future we're going to be kind of like we are today, maybe a little different, more of the same. But when you look back at the past of this watershed, it doesn't work that way. There have been dramatic changes in some periods.
Absolutely. There have been enormous changes. And, of course, if you read about the history of Madison or look at old photos of Madison, where old might be the 1960s or 1970s, you realize that in just a few decades, our region has changed tremendously. And that's true of the whole state, the whole country.
And a big part of the environment, when I think of limnology, I think you're out there collecting samples in the lake, and it's the science side of that. And that's a part of the project. But it seems like a big emphasis on here is what we do, what we people do, how we live, what we eat, how we behave, and what our values are. How important is that?
That's incredibly important, and it's historically it's been excluded from ecology and limnology. But of course, people are here to stay, and what we do changes our environment, and our environment changes us. And so, it's impossible to think about change without thinking about people and the natural world interacting.
Before we look at how we're trying to project or imagine the future, let's look back at the past, get our feet wet with some examples. Talk about something like agriculture's development in this watershed and how phosphorus has ended up being such an important factor in what lakes look like.
Sure. Agriculture began here in the 1840s when the first settlers came. We know that by 1870, as much land was plowed as would ever be plowed. And we see that in the sediments of the lakes. When we take a core from the lakes, we see black sediment on top. Those are the recent ones. And around 1870, the core turns gray, and those gray or whitish sediments are the ancestral ones, the ones that existed before those rich prairie soils came into the lake. After World War II, agriculture began to become much more mechanized, and commercial fertilizers were used more widely. Dairy herd sizes gradually began to increase. Of course, they've reached very large size today. And we began to develop phosphorus problems with our lakes. Phosphorus is an essential nutrient, but too much of it degrades water quality and leads to the sorts of toxic algae that we are beset with today.
This project focuses on the AHARA watershed. This issue you're talking about does not. This is something that people all over Wisconsin are talking about.
This is something that's occurring all over the world, actually. And the summer of 2016 was really the summer of algae blooms. We had huge blooms in Lake Okeechobee. We had unprecedented blooms in the ocean on the East Coast, and blooms that have never happened before. Of course, there was the famous Lake Erie case here in Wisconsin. Lake Pepin had very severe blooms, and lots of other lakes in the agricultural regions of Wisconsin are suffering from these toxic algae.
Let's complete the circle here. Now, this is coming from, in large part, agricultural runoff, human behavior in general. What What do we lose when we get these kind of blooms? What's the impact on us?
Well, for one thing, you can't drink the water. So municipalities that rely on the water for drinking have to go to bottled water or pay a lot of money to purify it. It also impacts recreation. It impacts real estate along the lakes. The lakes are a big part of Wisconsin's tourism industry. And we know that the algae blooms cost us literally hundreds of millions of dollars due to the damage they cause.
We're talking to Steve Carpenter with the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. Looking at this project he's part of called Yahara 2070, taking a long view on one particular watershed in south central Wisconsin. Let's start looking out into the future now. This is a very ambitious project, and it started in a way with focus groups, it sounds like, talking to people in the area to talk about what the future could, would, should be, or could be feared to be.
Well, that's right. People create the future, and we wanted to know what people's expectations of the future were. What did they fear? What did they hope for? And we gathered this information in focus groups and in interviews and in surveys, and then we put it together, and of course, every person has a story, and we couldn't tell them all, but we condensed it into four different stories about the future that were really built around the ideas that people had. So, for example, one of the stories asked, what happens if we really amplify technological development in our region? We're already really good at biotech. We're really good at high tech with some companies that are world leaders in those areas. What if we added green tech and really amplified our investment in education and development of those technology sectors? And we used the green tech to fix our own environment. So we sort of became the experimental guinea pig for our own technological development.
That's one of the scenarios. Another is we do nothing, almost a worst case scenario. Can you talk about that one a little?
Well, that's right. We felt that we needed to have a repeller scenario in the stories. And actually, we had a lot of people who thought, well, the environment's not that big a deal. We'll figure something out. Let's not do anything. We also had people we interviewed who thought, you know, getting the population lower would be a really good idea. So in the disaster scenario, we get the population lower, and there is an airborne toxin that evolves in the deadly bacteria of the Madison Lakes and kills a lot of people, drives a lot of other people out. And so we play out the consequences of that large human exodus in that story.
So as you say, there were four scenarios in all, and at that point, if you stop there, it's just like, oh, this is kind of science fiction. But it looks like you take these scenarios and try to science it out a lot and talk about, if this happens, what would that mean? And really down, what would it mean for water absorption by the ground, phosphorus, things like that?
Absolutely. There are many things we can compute about the future if we make some assumptions about human behavior. And the stories essentially give us the assumptions about human behavior. We can then translate those into computer models. And for things that can be calculated, such as water quality, flood frequency, carbon storage in the soil, food production, we can actually calculate what would be generated.
And you're still working on these models, as I understand it, but you found unintended consequences sometimes. One I saw in the documentary, I think, was about corn. Taking away corn from the watershed, what impact would that have on phosphorus? It's not as obvious as it might look.
It's not as obvious as you might think. Normally, we think of corn as a highly polluting plant because the ground is bare 9 months of the year, so the soil is just running off into the lake. So, you know, so normally you think that converting land to corn is going to be harmful to water quality and to groundwater. But it's also important to remember that corn is really, really good at taking up phosphorus. And it's way better than a lot of other plants at taking up phosphorus. So as climate change lets us run a longer growing season for corn, we might actually be able to use corn along with cover crops to remove phosphorus from the soil. And this was an angle we had not expected at all.
So you've got these focus groups in a way, you've built these scenarios, you're putting them to scientific modeling. So what? What do we do with all this when you come out with this information?
Well, I think that we will be able to point to some things for individuals and for policymakers to consider in the future that they haven't thought of. For example, our flood simulations showed planners in Madison and Dane County some consequences of flooding that they had not anticipated. And we pointed out how climate change could easily make flood far worse than anything we had seen so far. And they began to take up that information and incorporate it in their planning. We also are generating a lot of ideas about how to manage phosphorus on the landscape.
This, again, it's an ambitious project, pretty amazing. Has anybody done anything like this elsewhere before that you know of?
I'm not aware of any regional project that has the degree of modeling that we have. There have been, of course, surveys of people and focus groups on environmental things. But what we did is we brought together the human side with the computing side in a way that I believe is unprecedented for regional studies.
Are people around the country kind of watching, taking notes, and thinking we should do something like this here?
We are getting a tremendous amount of inquiry actually from all around the world. And I and other investigators have been invited to speak at a number of conferences. And I think it's generating quite a bit of excitement. Yes.
Steve, thanks a lot and good luck with the project going forward.
Well, Rob, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed chatting with you about it.
That was Steve Carpenter, the director of the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. His work is featured in the new Wisconsin Public Television documentary, Yahara Watershed, A Place of Change. That's airing tonight at 7:30. You can also catch it on Milwaukee Public Television on Friday, October 14th at 6 p.m. on Channel 36.
Seems like everywhere you turn these days, there's a common refrain heard over and over. Human beings are getting more selfish and narcissistic these days. There's a laundry list of culprits: social media, selfies, helicopter parenting, participation trophies, and more. But is there really any truth to that theory?
Our next guest wondered just how we got to this point, and she ended up with some bigger questions. Just how do we become so afraid of an extremely rare clinical diagnosis, narcissistic personality disorder, and what does it say about our culture and about us?
Kristen Dombeck joins us now. She's an essayist and cultural journalist, and her new book is called The Selfishness of Others, an essay on the fear of narcissism. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
So it seems like there's lots of things we can say about a person, but one of the worst we can say about them these days is that they're a narcissist. Why do you think it's taken on this this mantle of being especially bad?
Well, it is bad. I think what we mean is that this is a person who has no empathy, you know, who in this moment is lacking that basic human feeling. And that's something that more and more people seem to be feeling about others. And I got interested in why that was so.
Why did you get interested in it?
Well, a few years ago, I started hearing the word everywhere, and you know, it seemed to me I was hearing it more frequently. But I noticed that people use it often to mean different things. So when we say narcissist, we're saying that word, but sometimes we mean something else. So, for example, people don't say it about they don't call their new boyfriend a narcissist; they call their ex-boyfriend a narcissist, mm-hmm. right? Or they don't call politicians in their party narcissists, but there are, you know, memes going around the internet where politicians of the opposing party have the definition of narcissistic personality disorder printed over their faces, you know? So it's often a word that means there's some, I think, difference that is threatening or that we can't understand or that someone has turned away from us. So for that reason, it seemed like the word might be covering some things up that I wanted to explore.
Right. So have we broadened it beyond sort of the textbook definition of it to include a whole lot of other things that aren't necessarily narcissistic personality disorder?
Definitely. The textbook definition for clinical psychology and psychiatry is that a narcissist, it would be a person who's markedly different from our culture, who can't really function in relationships or on the job because, you know, they have a crushing sort of self-esteem that they have to cover over with this vanity. But the word now is being used, I think, to describe not someone who is the opposite of what we value in our culture, but, you know, everyone in our culture. And that's a change.
Well, can you give us some examples of the different areas in the arena of pop culture, culture at large, I guess, that this word is being used?
Sure. Well, it's it's being used to describe not only like political figures, as I said, but all the younger generation, all millennials, all selfie posters, the increase in memoir in publishing, all kinds of things.
And you start your book talking about an example from MTV, a 16-year-old girl from Atlanta, which, by the way, we should talk about Atlanta, but we'll put a thumbtack in that for now. But a 16-year-old girl from Atlanta who wants to shut down an entire road for her birthday. And she's an example of what we're talking about, narcissism at play in culture. Tell us about her.
Well, she's someone who the authors of a book called The Narcissism Epidemic, Jean Twenge and Keith Campbell, used as an example of what they call sociopathic narcissism, because on this television show she said that she wanted the street closed down. And they write about reality TV in general as a kind of, that reality TV stars are sort of super spreaders of the epidemic. I got curious about that and ended up interviewing Allison and to find out what really happened on that day, and discovered that what actually went on is a bit different than what they described. I did that because I noticed that when we make arguments that all of, say, the young are narcissistic and that the future is therefore something we should fear, we often tend to use a lot of anecdotes about these moments without, you know, looking at their context.
Well, and you said young people in particular, millennials, have been tarred with this narcissism brush. What is it about millennials that makes them more vulnerable to that criticism?
Well, surely it's because they are doing things that look on the surface like they're about drawing attention to the self. You know, so posting selfies with great ease and frequency is an example of that for a lot of critics, right?
We're talking with Kristen Dombeck right now, looking at narcissism and why, as a culture, we seem to be so freaked out by it right now, and what that says about us as a culture. And Kristen, why do you think it is having such a cultural moment right now, narcissism? Is there anything about a particular time that makes us want to accuse each other of this condition?
There's this an irony. There's so many ironies to this topic, and one of them is, of course, that as many other commentators have pointed out, we always feel this way throughout all of human history, right? that ours is the most selfish time ever. I mean, I grew up reading the Bible and in church, and this is the whole Old Testament. The wickedness is growing, right? But there's a bit of a historical narcissism, I guess, that we always have, right? Our moment is exceptional. It's worse than ever. But I think there is something really particular about our time there are a bunch of things that make this word the word we use. I was thinking about this on the train ride here. So I live in New York and I live in Brooklyn, and I discovered that no one I know has a landline, so I had to take the train. I took the train into Manhattan to talk to you at my publisher's. And on the train, the train jerked forward and a woman started to fall over. And in a split second, me and four other people reached out and caught her. And And it wasn't something we thought about. It was just that empathy that we have among us when we're physically together, when we're looking at each other. You know, it almost happens in the body. It's like nobody had to think about it, you know? Everyone just reached out. Right now, we have to figure out how to do that online when we're just seeing images of each other, and we have to do that through words. We don't feel that in the same way, and I think that that's very challenging, and that it's easier to see someone as shallow or to turn away, you know, when we're trying to understand who we can trust on such a wide scale and so rapidly. Do you find that's true?
Right. Well, I think what's interesting when you're talking about online examples where we're not physically together, and that is, I mean, the online space is the one thing we have in this particular moment that no one else has ever in history had before.
Yeah.
And it you know, we're there, we are looking at Instagrams of people or pictures of ourselves and trying to get a lot of likes. And you look at the, you know, the social media lives of people like Kim Kardashian and the trouble that Anthony Weiner's gotten into. I mean, it seems as though that definition of narcissism is sort of unique to our time, and the fact that we can observe ourselves being observed as we never have before. And so maybe there is something to it. Do you think there could be some critique there?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like the ways that we're communicating and the ways we're trying to create empathy and the ways we perform ourselves are different and are changing. I'm just curious about why pathologize it in others when we all are having to do it and we all have to learn how to empathize and be, you know, be good. And I understand. I mean, I think I wrote this book because I felt that way myself. You know, I felt afraid of this kind of growing superficiality, and I'm nervous anytime I posted a selfie. One thing I noticed is that as I was telling people that I was writing a book about narcissism, so many people would get nervous and start using the word a lot in their conversation with me, maybe to show me that they knew what it was and that they weren't one.
Well,
and that's interesting, right? That I think it's a thing that we fear being judged about because we all have to do it so much, and maybe that's part of why we then, you know, have these moments where it's just like, he's a narcissist. They're all narcissists, you know?
But not me. But yet everyone uses
me, right?
Those
because
words.
I have to do all these things that feel that way, you know, but I didn't, yeah.
Right, well, you kind of have to engage, you know, like we do here at work. We have to engage in social media. It's where the conversation takes place a lot of the time when it's not on the radio. And a lot of people, I think, feel that way. And I think you wrote about how maybe some words reflect this. People use the word I more often and me more often than they used to years ago. I mean, what does that say to you?
Yeah, but, I mean, as you just said, we often are compelled to, I'm not a social psychologist. I'm just kind of meditating on these things, reading the internet and meditating on them, but I wonder if part of why we do that online is to create a kind of presence, to say, I'm here, you know, are you here? That we speak from I rather than say, like, if all my Facebook posts were objective, like, you know, like just telling people what's up without saying, this happened to me and this is what I think, then I think it would be harder to create a conversation, right? So there might be another reason why we speak from the I. Of course, not always, but I just, I think that maybe we're called upon to do that.
We're talking right now with cultural critic Kristen Dombeck, and we're looking at narcissism and why as a culture it seems to be something we're focusing a lot of energy on right now, and it's become one of the worst insults that you can hurl at someone, that they're a narcissist.
You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you think we are more narcissistic than we used to be? If so, why? And what do you mean by narcissistic in this context? Or do you think we're just looking for it more? We're more worried about it. Do you post selfies? Why? How do you feel when you do it? Do you feel a little weird about it? Or is it just part of how you situate yourself and the things you've been doing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now with Kristen Dombeck. Her new book is The Selfishness of Others, an essay on the fear of narcissism.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Is narcissism turning into an epidemic in our culture, or are those fears being universalized and overblown? And just what is it that gets to us about narcissism? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Kristen, going forward, one of the things you talk about is the narcissphere. This is this sort of cottage industry around treating people with narcissism and also, you know, sort of dealing with it yourself, support grouping, when you feel like you're in a relationship with someone who's a narcissist. You kind of investigated what you call the narcissphere. What did you find?
Well, I found, first of all, that there are, you know, forums and sort of online therapists and psychologists, or even kind of life coaches who are giving advice about relationships, who, you know, are doing really good work and providing a place for people who are in abusive relationships to get help in getting out. And I just, you know, I wanted in every paragraph of the book I write to begin by saying, if you're in a relationship with someone who's in this, you know, who really is without empathy for you, then this is not what I'm talking about, right? But what I also saw is that there's a proliferation of sort of encouragement to diagnose. And to diagnose, I don't know about in your computer, but it, you know, scrolls down my screen all the time, like these listicle diagnoses, like five signs that your, you know, boyfriend is a sociopath, and things like that that are kind of addictive, right? To get this kind of psychological objectivity and then figure out your life through it. So I spent some time there and tried to write in that language, and also to think about what it's like to live in an age where we're doing online diagnosis and be encouraged to do diagnosis.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Aaron on the line with us in Spring Green. And by the way, you can join us as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if you're a psychologist or psychiatrist, do you have thoughts about our seeming cultural interest in narcissism right now and why it's become sort of the insult or the concern, maybe rather, of the moment? Now let's go to Erin now. Erin, hi.
Hi. My thoughts were just that I don't know if we're necessarily more narcissistic than we were, say, 10, 20 years ago. I think we just have the technology now to express ourselves and for people to see, quote-unquote, our narcissism. It's just more visible, and there are more technologies that allow us to look into people's lives. One example with this is, you know, people used to invite their neighbors over to look at their family slideshows when they went on vacation to the Grand Canyon, but slideshows were harder to set up and that sort of thing, and now we can just pop a picture of ourselves up in 2 seconds and share that with the world.
Right. Thanks for that point, Erin. And now we do have all these tools, which maybe appear as though, look, we're so much more narcissistic than we used to be, but we maybe had those same things just in a different format 20, 30 years ago. What do you think, Kristen?
I think that's a great point. And the slideshow of the family vacation is a really great example of how this has changed. And so then also we're seeing these displays of what we can judge as narcissism at a much greater rate, right? And we're figuring out how to process that more speedily than we ever have before. Yeah.
Well, Erin, thanks a lot for that call. And we mentioned Atlanta earlier, Kristen, and it seemed as though in your book, to read it one way, Atlanta is a hotbed of narcissism. Is there anything to that? Is there something going on in Atlanta?
No, it's a ridiculous claim. It's sort of it's a joke about my own paranoia and about how we see things only from the place where we are. So my very not narcissistic boyfriend is from Atlanta. And he's, you know, he's a deeply empathetic person. But but like anyone, we have moments in our relationship where he sees me as stunningly selfish, or I see him as stunningly selfish. You know, and the part of the work of love is like allowing, you know, kind of moving past that, right? Like understanding each other. But when I was reading The Narcissism Epidemic, a lot of the examples seem to be from Atlanta to me, including, you know, this girl Allison, who tried to shut down Peachtree Street, and that kind of joke. And it turned out one of the authors is from Atlanta, and so, of course, he's telling stories from where he lives. And it may not be. I started counting, and there may not be more examples from Atlanta than from other places. It's just those are the ones I noticed, right?
So the girl you were talking about from Atlanta who wanted to shut down Peachtree Street, it's hard to say, for her 16th birthday. She was from Atlanta, and you said you talked to her, and you found out the setup that you'd seen on MTV wasn't quite exactly what happened. Was there something there that did make her more empathic than she seemed on TV?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Her birthday party had actually been planned and by her father, and was already sort of all set up when MTV had approached them. And she talks about going on the show and being encouraged to pretend as if she's planning the party and demanding things. And she really loved her father, who loved to throw parties, and so she was, as she explained it to me, trying to sort of please him and be close to him. And for this reason, she performed as a reality television star in the way in which she was encouraged to perform. But what's under the surface is actually a real connection to her family that I very much trusted talking to her, you know? And that's kind of the opposite of the way that she got portrayed.
And do you think that's a template for a lot of these stories about so-called narcissism, that it might seem like someone has this horrible disorder and they're suffering from severe narcissism, but in reality, maybe there's more to us than a lot of that. We don't have that classical narcissistic personality disorder for real.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that there aren't, you know, people who you should... you know, when you see a pattern of that, right, of that kind of behavior, then that's someone you should, as many of the narcissphere sites say, run away from. But, of course, I feel, and part of the reason I wrote the book is that despite the speed on which we're encountering each other on the Internet, like, we have to develop, or I guess I'm trying to develop a sense, wait, there's always more than meets the eye here, you know? We are deeper than that still.
You mentioned empathy a bunch of times during our conversation today, and it's interesting because narcissism is a buzzword of our times, but so is empathy. We hear a lot about developing empathy and also compassion, so do you think that maybe there's a balancing force going on in our culture that, yes, we're obsessed with narcissists and pointing them out, but also we're interested in developing empathy?
And maybe even our interest in condemning narcissism is a symptom of, like, how much we value empathy. I mean, it's, you know, the phrase, I feel you, right? I feel you, is like our way of responding to people. And maybe because of some of the things we've been talking about the way we perform online and see each other perform online, like, and because of the great injustices that we see in the world and the violence, like, we are calling out for empathy, I think, which would imply that we're not narcissists, right? But that we want to say this is not what we value.
That's a great place to leave it. So, Kristen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Kristen Dombeck. She's an essayist and cultural journalist, and her new book is called The Selfishness of Others, an Essay on the Fear of Narcissism.
And you can still join in on this conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. An interesting point to proceed with there. Do you think narcissism is winning out in our culture, or empathy? Are you seeing more and more empathy among the people you know, maybe the future generations, the kids are all right, or... do you think, as some people have said, we're getting more narcissistic, more self-involved, self-absorbed, selfish over time? And is it the Internet's fault or credit? Again, share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. The origins of life on Earth keep getting pushed back further and further, and a new discovery just published in the journal Nature may push it back even more.
Scientists working on some of the world's oldest rocks in Greenland, exposed by the effects of global warming, say they found the fossilized remains of a life form that's about 3.7 billion years old.
Now, this would not have been a very lively life form, a globby mat of microbes, but researchers say these microbes would not have been the first kind of life on Earth. They could do things like photosynthesize, which takes some evolving to do.
Globby mat of microbes, is that how they described it?
I kind of paraphrased, yeah.
Okay.
It's got a certain poetry to it, though.
Well, there's more research needed to make sure that this really was fossilized life or a globby mat of fossilized microbes. But if it is, it would continue a trend. Discoveries that keep showing that life on Earth started earlier than we thought for quite a while.
Yeah, and reading about this one not that long ago, we thought, oh, it was just a billion, just.
a billion years ago.
Then two, then three. Now we're closing in on 4 billion, close to when Earth started. That's making them think, hey, maybe life on other planets, not so hard to pull off.
When you go that far back in time, I don't know about you, but my brain just sort of short circuits. I have no idea how to even think about what billions of years is like.
The scope is a bit much for me to comprehend. I mean, it's a bit older than me, is what I've figured out.
Just a bit.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.